So I'm going to talk, as she mentioned, about reliability and how we tackle it at Netflix. It's a very distributed function, and it's something especially my team has been thinking about more in recent times. So a little bit about me real quick. That's pretty loud, right? Okay. I manage the cloud performance and reliability team and capacity team. So we have a lot of functions within our team at Netflix. My team manages the reactive and proactive consultation with the organization. One of my more famous team members is Brendan Gregg. So we tend to get involved when people get in sort of hairy situations, but everybody has a pretty good level of operational capability on their team. I blogged recently about some tooling we built. So my team is in charge of determining how we can consume very large amounts of data and try to make it presentable to users so they can actually solve problems. I drive best practices around operational behavior in the environment. That's something we're building on a bit. And we optimize AWS Cloud. A couple other things we do on call as a team, but we're more like an escalation resource, right? Like customer support might call, our crisis response team, and if they need us to dive in and get figure out what's going on, we'll do that. I'm hiring, as probably most people are here, and I'll be handing out some stickers after the talk. I don't know if I'm going to have enough, but I'll try to get those handed out. Netflix, people know Netflix pretty well. Probably the thing that changes the most is our stats over time. We're still sort of a pure play business, right? We focus on streaming content to people and trying to buy better content to stream to you. We are very early to the cloud. I would it'd be hard to argue that we probably aren't one of the larger and more complex workloads on AWS. We're across three AWS regions. We auto scale in each region, maybe 3,000-4,000 instances a day. So we're very dynamic in our nature. In 2013, we actually brought in our ability to fail over traffic between east and west. And we've done it in the last 9 days, and if you didn't notice, that's great. It was unplanned. Sometimes it's planned, sometimes it's unplanned. And so that's great for us to be on the cloud. We found it to be fantastic from an elasticity perspective. But it sets a little context about how we have unique problems we need to tackle as well. Netflix has a freedom and responsibility culture that people talk about quite a bit out in the industry, I think even beyond technology. Example is, we have about 1,000 engineers, a little over that. They're all in Los Gatos, right? We have no one else anywhere else in the world for the most part. Everybody has root access to production, so all 1,000 people can immediately root into any system in production, barring the PCI compliance systems, and do what they want, right? But we hire people that make sure they do the right thing. We're up to about 34% of internet traffic at night in the US, and about 6% of that is upload. Some people say, well, why do you have such a massive footprint if when I play a movie, you're just streaming bits to me after it starts? We're actually getting a lot of information back from you as well, where your bookmarks are, what you watched, the rate at which you watch various series. We build and maintain our own CDN. It's called Open Connect. We started that about 3 years ago. It's a free BSD-based appliance that we make available to all ISPs if they want it, and people that we peer with. It's been fantastic for us. But that's one thing that people have traditionally misunderstood. They thought that we streamed content off Amazon. We don't stream our content off Amazon, and they're probably pretty glad that we don't. So we do that off our own CDN. It'd probably be a problem for both of us. And then right now we're at about 2 billion hours of streaming a month. I guess 1 billion hours, it's equal to like 100,000 years of video in a month or something. So it's a pretty crazy amount of streaming we do. We have over 55 million subscribers now. We're growing more globally. You'll see some stuff happening this year, hopefully. And we have a strong focus on originals. So hopefully there's one original that if people are Netflix fans, they found of interest to them. We keep cranking them out. I actually like most of them. And I watch them all the time. So what is the challenge? The challenge for us as an organization, we're a very high leverage organization. As I said, we only have about 1,000 engineers across maybe 30 service engineering teams running as a microservice. So how do we break down the responsibilities that are required to make the application overall, and the application being Netflix streaming when you push the button, be appropriately available? And how do you balance that responsibilities within the team, right? Most teams probably range from maybe 6 to 20 individuals. And within that team, you have to decide how deep or broad you're going to go on dev versus ops. We've also embraced a shared model from an ops responsibility perspective. And that's another trade-off, because you have to take into account all these factors I'm going to talk about. I think being in a large microservice architecture where you have many different teams, it adds a lot of additional complexity compared to, say, maybe a monolithic Java app, which most people probably aren't running these days. but you're running a pretty simple stack. Everybody's behind it. They have a push schedule. It goes out a certain time. Everybody wakes up at a certain time, rolls it back, whatever the plan is. There's a lot of moving parts, and there's a lot of frameworks that get introduced, right? Every day, I think we're all pretty excited when we see like a tweet that talks about some awesome new reliability framework that does this or circuits that. For the organizations, when you adopt those, there's a certain level of operational responsibility that comes with it to use it correctly, right? I'll dive on that as well. And I don't know if you guys have seen this, but if you look at your organization and you are based on microservices, as you're closer to the edge or the teams that actually tend to push code more frequently to pick up, say, assets of other services, they tend to have more operational complexity they deal with day to day, right? They get woken up more often. They often drive the creation of frameworks that ensure better resiliency. And so when you look at how you split things across the team and how you make it shared versus distributed, not everybody's equal. You might want to have sort of an equal bar across all the teams, but there's different stakeholders with different needs, even within your organization, and that's something that's a challenge for us. I should have had a smaller lunch. So this is my idea of like a primitive DevOps model. We adopted it quite some time ago. It's really awesome to go into a company where they're like, here's the keys, go crazy, right? You can go to production, like at Netflix, come in. Here's root access, go wherever you want, right? But if you create a DevOps model, it's an incredible amount of power for someone who hasn't been in a company like that, and I've been at a few like HP and others where I felt quite constrained, to come to an organization and be given such incredible power over your own fate, right? The ability to push code when you want. But I sort of feel like there's scissors involved and people are running around, and at times you're sort of crossing your fingers and you get that momentum and everybody's like, look, everybody's pushing code, this is awesome. Wait, the site's down, it's starting to go down more often, right? And how do you try to turn that around? Because the last thing you want to do is take away the scissors, but just have people be able to run faster without cutting themselves, might be a good example. So when you get people in DevOps, you give them these keys to production, like, hey, I'm just going to push the code into production. It's great. I have this script that does it. I might do it for my own little, my own scheduler. It's awesome. And as a company, you really want to encourage that. We know that pushing code more frequently, there's fewer bugs in each cycle. You get features out more quickly. I mean, the DevOps model and the ability to push code quickly, I think, has been proven out pretty well. But there's a lot of implicit guidance we give teams. And this is something that, I don't know if you see in your company, but when there is an outage in production, you go, oh yeah, you know, I just wish that person had caught their bad code, right? Or, we're global now, and so what's the point of us pushing code that might take down the whole world at once? Why don't we stagger it a little bit? Let's maybe push it to this region, then that region, then go to EU, and we can follow the sun a little bit so we reduce that impact. What are some other things? Rolling back quickly if needed. We did a quick rollback today in about 5 minutes this morning that I saw in one of our regions. Creating and maintaining effective alerts. It sounds pretty easy, right? Like I'm just going to slap some alerts on your system and you're going to get woken up when there's a problem. But when you start looking at the complexities of some of these systems and the interactions, defining the right alerts are often very specific to a given service. And so we found that we could say to someone, why didn't you get alerted? Why didn't you wake up? And it's because there's a whole philosophy behind that. Tuning circuits, I'll go into that. Ensuring sufficient capacity. Most of us probably have fairly bursty workloads that are unpredictable to some degree. We don't want the site to go down if there's a big rush of traffic. So our guidance to teams is make sure you have enough capacity, but not too much, right? Don't break the bank and don't take capacity we need for other services. This is particularly true to our model where all engineering teams share the same AWS account, right? Again, with the exception of our PCI environment, but we have a gigantic set of reservations. Everybody pushes whenever they want. Nobody has to procure anything, and behind the scenes, my team working with some other teams make sure the capacity is there. So that's a real tricky one. And then once you have everything in production, you pushed your code, everybody's happy. We know that over time, especially on the cloud, the reliability of things change, right? You might have 100 of these, and one of them starts getting into a little bit of a wedge state. Maybe it has a network problem. Don't let that get too bad. Why don't you go and kill that guy off? Do something about it. So this would be a primitive model where you tell teams, sure, ahead, go ahead, push to production, but make sure you don't do this, right? And it's a little bit scary. I think it's a really high bar, and we notice this. One of the compounding factors is when you look at these service teams where they're on the edge, they're pushing code frequently, they live the operational life in and out to some level, they're dealing with all these fires. And then as you work your way back in the stack, you might have microservices that are smaller and smaller in terms of their functional scope. Those people tend to see less production issues because of how we've wired the whole system up. And so some of the feedback I've heard from managers is, you know, this complicates the hiring strategy, right? You're telling me that I can go hire people, they have DevOps capabilities, which is great, but I need them to build this really awesome feature maybe around billing or about drawing a row of movies. But at the same time, everybody's on call within that team. Everybody needs to know how to get code into production, roll it back, set up alerts. And finding that magical person can be a little bit challenging. Someone earlier talked about diluting the operational focus of a team. So there's a lot of things in the day-to-day that a team needs to do to operate in a safe fashion. If you don't reduce this list in some way, I think it becomes overburdening, and they end up spending a lot of time doing that. And to the last point, it can be a little bit challenging on morale. I think most people that come to a company that has adopted DevOps, they're super excited. They can push their code whenever they want. It's really great, and it's really great for like maybe the first month or two. And then you want to do something else besides write scripts to push code and deal with rollbacks and all the other stuff, right? So it's exciting to learn. It's not exciting to do in an ongoing basis. We're seeing a lot of configuration drift. We've now been in a microservice architecture long enough that out in the environment, we find that people are coding against certain APIs using certain push models that starts putting a lot of technical legacy out there, or technical debt, sorry, and it makes it challenging for us to make new changes that we think are important. The last one there, or the second to last one, about development of operational point solutions, what you'll probably find is there's a need that of some organization. If you're not going to build a tool to help them get there or develop in collaboration, they'll build it anyway, right? They might want their own canary analysis. Maybe the other 20 teams don't need it. They're going to go off and build it, and then at some point you'll be involved in trying to figure out what's going on there. But no one's going to do things manually for very long, and so it's important that you try to meet them halfway. I think we're pretty good in the model of where we meet the microservice engineering teams of building solutions, but it's something we can do better. So one possible solution. We actually have operations engineering in the name of my parent team, and it was interesting during the keynote when they talked about the word operations, so say production engineering versus operations. I would lie if I said it wasn't a very contentious subject at our offsite when the small group of managers were saying we don't want operations in our title because it's a little, you know, some people don't want operations in their title. That's just the way it falls. But we felt within the organization it was a very clear line of the role we played, and our job was to improve the underlying engineering around the operational behavior of the organization. And we've had a really strong message with everybody inside. It's pretty clear what we do. You know, we're in charge of engineering better operations. The slogan of our team is shifting the curve, right? You've got to have a logo. And if you look on the left there, there's the traditional model where as the rate of change increases, your availability decreases in an environment if you change nothing. We've seen that where we bring more services in, we maybe go to new regions, our push rate goes up, and we start having more, I wouldn't call them full outages, but we have more incidents, right? Rates in which alerts are going off, there might be abnormal behavior in the system somewhere. So operations engineering, our underlying tenet is that we can actually increase the rate of change, which is one primary direction of our tools, which I'll talk about. But at the same time, we're not going to compromise availability in any way. So you're really looking at both of these dimensions at the same time. And when we're building tools and creating methodologies, our goal is to move both of these, or at least keep that line as we're pushing it out. And I think we're being pretty successful in it. But it's nice having this as a model for our organization because it helps focus what we do. If we're doing something that increases the rate of change but puts reliability or availability at risk, then it's probably not a good investment. We have five teams, some of them in the tools you've probably heard of before. So within operations engineering of these five teams, engineering tools is probably one of the most well-known, right? So when we went to the cloud, we built something called Asgard that allows you to deploy and manage your configuration on the cloud. They've also built teams like Nebula, which is a build plugin. And we have insight engineering, crisis response engineering, traffic and chaos, and then my team. So in terms of the breakdown, there's very little overlap between what these teams do. The engineering tools team is in charge of putting the frameworks in place to make sure that your code gets from commit through Jenkins, baked into an AMI, registered into an ASG, scaled up. That's engineering tools. They do all of that. So they own the bakery, they own the underlying framework. Insight engineering, we recently open sourced Atlas, which is our large monitoring, very large monitoring solution on the cloud. So a lot of these were built out of shortcomings in commercial tools where we would either break the scale of what they needed or they had such a broad capability set that we didn't need it, and it would take a while to get what we would need as an organization through their probably product feature list would be my guess. So Atlas, I think it currently pulls in a little over a billion metrics per minute from our environment, and then it aggregates them and makes them available to users and other systems for consumption. And we recently open sourced it, I think I mentioned that. There's a bunch of other tools that layer on top of Atlas. In the keynote, he talked about sort of an auditing framework. We have something called Kronos. So when someone makes a change, whether they check in code, they tear down an auto-scaling group, they change a security group, it's all pumped into one system, and we have the ability to identify when some change has affected the environment. They also build canary analysis, they do server outlier detection. They really give us insight. Crisis response engineering is a team. Their job is to identify when something is going wrong, if someone hasn't identified it already. Work to triage it, get the right teams involved, and then have appropriate follow-ups to make sure that that problem doesn't happen again. They're a key part of our organization. All of these teams build tools to support this, but first and foremost, their responsibilities are clear in terms of just methodology and engagement. Traffic and chaos. So when I talked about having to fail traffic over between regions, we have a team whose job it is to understand how to shift all of these devices from one location to another globally. We started doing that about a year ago, and they build the framework for that, taking into account Route 53, various DNS capabilities. And then chaos, we talk about it a lot. It's a somewhat new function where it's very proactive. We take and we inject failures into the system. We're building frameworks where I can take a subset of requests, and as it's flowing through the system, say, fail this service, and then expose if I have an error. And then that generates action items to go work with the team to say, your fallback doesn't work. We need to make this more resilient. And then my team, I already outlined pretty much what we do, but it's performance, reliability, and capacity in parentheses there. But we try to open source tools when we can. My team's going to be open sourcing a tool in a couple weeks. I'll talk about in a minute. But that's the general structure. We found it fits pretty well. These aren't completely flat. If you look at engineering tools, there's actually sub-teams under there. There's like a build tools team and a systems engineering team. Those teams in general are never more than 7 people. My team's 7 people. So these are all pretty small teams. But we do subdivide to compartmentalize it. And again, we're all on Los Gatos. So along the accelerating engineering velocity dimension, we'd like to allow people to get code into production as quickly as possible, but ideally no quickly than it needs to be to avoid breaking things. And there's obviously undifferentiated heavy lifting. There's some that you guys might have seen in your company where you're going, you're like, hey, everybody needs to do this one thing. I'm going to build a little wrapper around it, expose a tool for them, tie it into the build system. We try to do that across all of those dimensions, which is what are people doing today that they shouldn't really have to do? Or how can we package it in a way with a nice bow so it's easier for them to consume? And Netflix is an organization, I want to come back to the freedom and responsibility culture. It's really about context over control. We push data back to people constantly in terms of this is the rate at which, say, your code's getting rolled back, this is your performance metrics, this is your cost and your efficiency. And it's not our job as a support team to give them any input on whether that's good or bad. They can ask our opinion about it, but in general, our assumption is they want these characteristics to be as good as possible or the bar to be as high as possible. So we focus on giving that information back to them. And nothing's driven by a mandate, which adds a nice additional flavor to the tooling. If you build something that's crap, no one's going to use it, right? So our goal is to not build crap and get people to use it and then see that uptake. So if that's the general strategy, which is to dive into these various domains and figure out how to solve it, then you have the fun challenge of, okay, what are the right problems to solve right now based on where people are at in our organization, and how do we take into account their levels of skills and how they vary by each of the teams? So I'm going to talk about some of the specific strategies we've applied. There's probably your 20, 30 I could dive into, but I'm going to focus a little bit more on maybe 5 or 6 that I think are real critical in terms of the operational aspect and how we tailor it to meet various people's needs. So the engineering tools team has implemented something called build pipelines. And so when you stand back and look at the problem, the way that, when we first created our deployment tooling, we looked, okay, here's Amazon, someone has their code, they need to check it in, they need to build it, they need to deploy it, we're going to create an interface. And we created Asgard because the Amazon Web Console at the time didn't really support ASGs and rolling pushes, so we built that framework. And that got us a long ways, right? We had all these teams pushing code, things weren't breaking that often. And then we started going globally, right? We picked up EU, and then we had active in the US. And then we noticed that we started having failures around deployment of code because there wasn't a common pattern which was being applied. People would push them based on how they wanted to script it. They're like, this is a low priority change. I'm just going to push it out and push it everywhere and run it. And then we'd have a problem and we'd have to roll back, unfortunately, sometimes in all regions, but it would sometimes have a global impact, which is unfortunate. So we built this new interface, and this is all REST API driven behind the scenes. You'll hear more about this over probably the next year as the engineering tools team starts to roll it out. But it allows you to set up a pipeline with different strategies of how your code wants, you want your code to get into production. You can tie it into your build system, so at the end of a build, you can have a build that marks this as sort of the golden build that's passed all the functional tests. And in the configuration, this is actually a manual execution prod. This is just a utility I have on my team. But you can see on the bottom, we deployed it. It took like 10 minutes, but it goes through various phases. So once my code's ready, it's been built, it's checked into Artifactory, wherever it resides, the framework behind the scenes will actually bake it in the region and deploy it in that region. And then you can put in delays. You can have more canary analysis in there, where if it fails canary analysis, it actually pauses it. And I'll talk about canary analysis in a minute. And then it goes to US West, both a bake and a deploy. I think Amazon's exposing the ability to bake, like register in multiple regions pretty soon, but we're doing this ourselves today as we push it across the globe. And at the end of it, your new code's running, and as part of this, you can incorporate push strategies, right? Which is, I want a red black. We have a new push strategy. It's pretty funny, it's called Highlander, like the movie, right? There can you be only one. And so when you select the Highlander strategy, it just shoots your old thing and stands up your new one. It's really cool from a capacity perspective. I'm real happy with that. But for the most part, we tend to push new code and roll the traffic over gradually. This was a manual execution. Some people have very complex pipelines that run across the different regions. But by getting everybody tied into this, even with the APIs, we have very level high-level APIs. So once you construct your pipeline and you associate the regions, the order, the timing, the canary analysis rules, it's as simple as them making an API call from wherever they want to tie into it, whether their build system or if they still want to consume it somewhere else. But by providing such sort of a rich layer around pipeline builds, we can now change it over time if we want to. We found with Asgard that we got a lot of people writing directly to it, and maybe the granularity of the functionality could have been a little bit better in terms of the abstraction. And so now we're putting something in place where we see, you know, this could easily support us hopefully for the next, say, 10 years in terms of being able to have people adopt it. And then we can change it under the covers if something comes up that we needs to be done. Catching bad code early. So I think for a couple years now, I've been using automated canary analysis in my presentations. Canary analysis is awesome. You guys probably, a lot of you probably run canaries in production. We've been doing this for quite some time in that people are pushing to code, and in production they probably push maybe between once a day for some of the big teams to maybe once every 2 to 4 weeks, right? Everybody's pushing on a different schedule. Nothing is coordinated internally except maybe like upgrades on infrastructure like Cassandra or some of the Memcache tiers. But in terms of canary analysis, we don't have load tests. One thing I didn't point out is we maintain a load testing tool as a service. So it's based on Jenkins and JMeter. And if you want to run really big, you know, badass load test with thousands of instances, you just write it up and run it through Jenkins and it goes. But it's not meant as something that would catch performance issues on your regular push schedule, right? That's really what canary analysis is. This is a case where your code has already passed your functional tests. You're pretty confident that it's going to do what it needs to do. But the question is, when it gets into production under production load and that different behavior with all of the dependencies around it, is something not right? So this is our new canary analysis interface and capability. But the way it works is it's almost a one-click configuration, I believe, where you have your standard cluster running, and this will set up what's called a baseline and a canary. And when you do a push, it will stand up a version of your old code and your new code and let it run for a period of time, giving it a subset of the production traffic. So you don't have to guess on what your workload is. You know that you're getting the same thing all the other nodes are getting that are servicing for that tier. And then you configure how you would like to score your metrics. This one only has 64 metrics that are taken into consideration. I think our front door services probably have maybe 300 to 400 metrics that are taken into account. So you run for some period of time. It does some statistical analysis, which is way over my head, and our insight team does that. but it lets you weigh the importance of the various metrics you want to compare. So this is a canary, I just grabbed this the other day, this is a canary score of marginal. And usually people can set thresholds where if the canary score is below a certain level, let's not do the push, give me a warning. But a team might be comfortable that marginal is fine and push to production. But you can see here on the right side, and maybe you can't because you're far away, but these are all metrics that are coming out of our Atlas reporting system. And at the bottom here, we have one that's actually high, and it's 12.8%, but you can see there's an EVCash metric up top, which is 15%, but it's a pass. And that's because they've gone and they've actually said, I'm more interested in applying a heavier weight to latency changes on my Memcache calls versus my checked operation timeout ratios. And that was an enhancement we did on canary analysis where we talked to the end users, and our initial implementation was really difficult to use. It was hard to configure. So the new implementation allows you to very flexibly select the metrics. If you have hundreds of metrics, you can do expression matching. And then you can assign weights because you know what's more important than others. So once you configure this for a service, it tends to be pretty good for a while because the profile of the services don't change that frequently themselves. And so you just have this out of the box. It makes me much more comfortable because I know that performance risk is captured much earlier. And I don't have any metrics to share with you on how often canary analysis does catch stuff, but I know it's at a fairly high rate because it just does so much machine-level analysis that a human couldn't do. Normally you'd be like, oh, my CPU's up 20%, and that's my flag. But this is much more fine-grained. Yes, in the back. No, I don't. I was just saying that. I didn't bring any data for that today. I apologize for that. Hopefully there'll be some more blog posts or something on our canary capability, but that would be useful. This is an example of a tool that was built initially in a very different form by our Edge team because they were pushing every day. Nobody else was. And we ended up taking that and applying that logic into a more formalized tool that everybody can adopt. So this is an example of where it's helpful to look at those teams with high rates of change, what problem they're having, and it turns out it's the same problem everybody's having. Okay. Tuning circuits. So this ties back to my point on having complex frameworks that are available within an environment. You obviously probably can't read this, but we created a framework called Hystrix, which I believe applies the bulkhead pattern that Mike Nygaard came up with, which allows you in an architecture to bulkhead or open a circuit and basically take a service that's not meeting your SLA, either from an error or performance perspective, open a circuit on that and throw a fallback. So as an example, think of, I'm a Netflix user and I want to see what movies you want me to play from popular on Netflix, right? So there's a call in to get the popular on Netflix row as an example. That row, again, would be personalized for you in our system. But let's say the service that provides that is having a problem. They're either having high error rates, they're under pressure, they did a push, something's broken. The Hystrix framework will identify that based on parameters you set. It'll open the circuit and it'll give a fallback to the upstream system. And that fallback is just a piece, some data that says, show this person a relatively unpersonalized row, right? Because it's more important to provide the ability to browse and play than say no row, right? We don't want to say no row, because we've done that before. So this framework itself, it's just a Java framework, but it has many tunables that are created within it. So it's a fantastic tool for making yourself resilient when there's localized failure, when your dependencies are having a problem. The challenge is it has maybe three critical values, and this is an example of I want a read timeout, I want my concurrency, and I want the number of errors to happen in a given time before I open my circuit, and then I'm going to close it again. There's a little bit of black magic involved in that, and we went in the company, and this is another case where we started noticing that there were a lot of incidents. And when we looked at those incidents, the incidents were happening because people didn't have these tuned correctly, right? Maybe they were getting a 99th percentile latency from a service of like 100 milliseconds, but they had the default timeout of 1 second, right? So the queue would fill up so quickly, the system would back up, threads would freak out and start backing up, and the system load average would go up. So this is a case where we probably have thousands of these in production across all these different services. It requires manual tuning, and nobody ever does that, right? This is something where it's like, hey, here's an awesome tool to make you more resilient. Why don't you go one day every week and see if it's up to date and tune it and understand all the characteristics of your dependencies? The risk is compounded in a microservice architecture like ours because I don't even have to push my code to have a problem, right? One of my dependencies could push a code. Their timeout changes, their error rate goes up. So we said, this must be solved. And we got engaged, and so we went and talked to the experts in the organization and said, you know, we're having these failures. You've given us this great framework. It's causing outages at this point, not outages, incidents. What's the right way to use it? And as you start talking to different teams in your organization, you'll actually get different answers. Someone on the edge might be very aggressive, like, I want to cut those people out as soon as they even sneeze. Like, I don't want to risk anything. Whereas down in the stack, people tend to be a little more conservative, like, let's let it run for a little bit. I think we'll be okay. We'll get through this. So you go to the organization, you find out how people want to use these awesome frameworks they've built. You identify some models based off that you can rationalize to other people. Probably 80% of the teams don't even really care what's happening in there, but there's going to be a small subset of experts in this domain that you want to keep in that tight loop. So we would go get the logic, we'd build a model. We did this either Q4 or Q1 on my team. You train it against a framework, so you want to actually see how it behaves, these systems behave when you're trying to evaluate the different error conditions, and you don't necessarily want to simulate those in production, like, hey, I'm just going to go fail this percentage of Netflix users. So you build like some little simulation frameworks. And once you validate it, then you want to figure out a way in which you can roll it out to everybody. So our Insight team has a real-time analytics framework. It's basically a pluggable module. I think it uses like OpenPy. And it allows us to take all this data from Atlas, pick out the metrics we want, build up an algorithm, and some cases just a simple heuristic, and then analyze the performance of a system each day for each of the service teams, and then send them recommendations. We would love to make this completely automatically tuning, but we might blow our foot off accidentally. So our goal is to sort of step into it. And so we're building it up. We're sending out emails to people. And one thing I wanted to call out was, you know, to not be discouraged, right? You're going to come up with these great ideas like, man, my team can create this awesome push capability or this awesome circuit tuning capability. And you're going to find people who say, well, that's not going to work for me. Look at my use case. You're always going to have people, at least in my experience, where it's not going to work for them. But my goal is to help out the larger audience. So if I get a 90-10 win on this, you know, if I take 90% of the incidents that are related to tuning and eliminate them through just an automated model, it's really worth it for me. And so we're going to be rolling it out this quarter. It took us about a quarter. We're a very quarterly driven project company. But you could take this, and instead of being tuned circuits, this could be almost any of the other methodologies we apply and we step across with various teams. One thing near and dear to my heart as owning the performance team is we try to build instrumentation that allow people to see, get greater insight into their system. And this is covered in the blog post from both the macro to a micro level, right? So you can say to a team, you know, there's tens of thousands of instances running out there. You pushed your code. Why don't you understand your performance behavior? Why don't you understand what's happening at an instance level? And we have Atlas. We have some great dashboards. But again, the level of experience across various teams, especially around, say, monitoring or dashboarding, isn't always the same. So if you look at it, we build tools on my team that are tools we use to solve problems. And if they're useful, we make them self-service, and we try to train everybody. That's how we can only have 7 people. Our goal is to have great leverage by giving people the tools they need to solve things that pop up. So on the left side, that's really the macro view. I mean, that diagram right there probably encompasses maybe, let's say, 8,000 servers running in production with traffic flowing through them in a given window. The width of the bar represents the demand on that service tier. Then you can see the flow to the downstream tier, and you can click on it, and you can actually expose additional data. This is not open sourced, by the way. It relies much on like a Dapper type framework, right? A transaction tracing system that's pumping data somewhere and putting a simple visualization on that. But this tells teams, these are my neighbors. This is who is talking to me over a given time. And so you can actually see multiple levels up of who's driving load to your system. So I consider that really the macro, the highest level view we would give to a team. The next one over we call Mogul, and we haven't open sourced that yet either. That depends on Atlas data. And the top graph represents the response time on your service is providing at an instance level and the throughput. And when you go to Atlas, you think, gosh, I really wish I could find out why I'm having this perturbation in my system profile. Why don't I go take 10,000 metrics and correlate them and then find it? Because you really can't. Like, it's hard to do that. So we go and we hit Atlas. We pull in what we think are critical metrics for each of these services, like what are my dependencies, who's calling into me, and the dependencies might be Cassandra, EV cache, downstream service tiers. We look at system resources, right, like threads blocked, CPU demand, disk activity, and we run a correlation algorithm. And out of, I think on our front door service, we pulled somewhere about maybe 10 to 15,000 metrics. We only show you like 6 graphs that include 5 metrics each, and those are the metrics that most closely have a correlation with the change in demand on your system. I covered that in the keynote. Again, this isn't really saying that is the root cause, but it's helping you at least sort of find your way through the weeds. And so the degree to which you can give teams tools to help understand their behavior and filter out the noise, extremely valuable. Bottom right, so in the cloud, a lot of times people will say, oh, my instance is bad, right? And you're like, damn it, another instance went bad. The question is, did the instance really go bad, or is it your code, right? And sometimes you can only answer that question by looking at high-resolution data for key sets of metrics at a granularity not visible on a system that's maybe showing you averages across a larger sample set. Someone might have 25% CPU utilization on a 4-core box. You're like, hey, that's great. But what it means is maybe one of the cores is pegged with one thread doing something bad. So Vector is a utility, which we're hoping we're going to open source this month. It leverages a framework called Performance Copilot that's open sourced. This is all covered in the blog post as well. But you can point at any instance and start getting high resolution metrics across various key system resources and see if there's the problem with the system itself. And then on the left there, we have the ability, Brendan Gregg on my team has a visualization technique called a flame graph. And so when you click a button, it will actually use perf, generate some perf event samples, you'll get CPU stack traces, and then it will construct it into a visualization for you, which you can navigate. You can very quickly see where the CPU time is being spent on the system. It doesn't show user space time right now. We're working on a patch of OpenJDK to do that, but this is something where people have navigated through, gotten to a problem, and we want to take them a little bit farther down. So these are some of the tools my team builds. And we couldn't build this without all of the other metrics we collect. So there's a lot of symbiotic behavior within our organization. So we're now at the point when I was talking about all the things you should do in production. One of them is eliminate outliers. Find those things which are starting to get off in the weeds, but they might not be bad enough or they might not be present in a high enough in terms of contribution or population representation, that they would actually cause an outage, right? This service is probably providing completely acceptable performance to its neighbors, but there, in this case, there's two instances towards the top. You can't really see, there's like a light pink line right here, where these have been running for some period of time, and something's changed in their behavior. They're just not acting normally. So I paraphrase Sesame Street here. But using the same RTA framework I talked about before, once you have that ability to put in some pluggable logic around system analysis, this is called Kepler. Cody on the Insight team spoke about this a few weeks ago. It's on Vimeo. But it's a capability where a service team can say, yeah, I want to use server outlier detection, and I can choose two options. You can either send me an email when something's misbehaving, or you can just shoot it for me. And most people choose to just shoot it, and we have a throttle on it to make sure. I think that was even mentioned in the keynote, that we don't kill everything at once. One area we are working on improving is tracking a little closer when these terminations occur, at what rate they're occurring, and do they require investigation, because many times, as you guys are familiar, you can only kill off a problem for so long until it becomes the dominant situation, like, say, a memory leak. We also have the luxury of, we push code frequently enough that these guys will get killed off over time, and then new code comes into production and everything's clean and fresh again in a couple days. But server outlier detection, you don't even have to go do this work yourself. You just get an email, or you just have the termination occur on your behalf. And you can point this to any of the hundreds of services, right? If a team wants to consume this, they go talk to the Insight team. They spend like maybe 3-4 minutes setting it up, maybe a little longer if it's complex, and then it's going. You don't even have to worry about it. It follows the ASGs along. It associates the clusters. So the monkeys. So our most famous probably operational contribution to Netflix is the Simian Army. And so this started with Chaos Monkeys down the bottom there with the guns. And then you can see the Security Monkey over there. I think that's a Pulp Fiction reference. And it goes all the way from the monkeys through the gorilla to Chaos Kong up there on top. But the goal is to apply just maintenance behavior against the system. that people don't have to worry about it. It's opt-in by default. So if you deploy an application in production at Netflix, Chaos Monkey is going to go and every now and then just shoot one of your instances, boom, EC2 terminate, just gets rid of it, right? And it guarantees that your services are reliable and we're built to support that failure. So we had a case recently where Amazon had to required us to reboot a fairly large part of our infrastructure due to a vulnerability. And even our Cassandra clusters, so stateful clusters, have adopted Chaos Monkey. So we went through that whole reboot exercise and had no incident or outage because everybody's constantly having instances killed in production. When you first start it, you sort of forget about it. You're like running some tests or doing something and stuff just dies. And you're like, what was that? And then it turns out it was Chaos Monkey paid you a visit. Security scans, we look for vulnerabilities in our code. We have a janitor monkey that cleans up unused resources. So in the test environment, you have something that's been sitting around for a couple weeks. No one's using it. There's no traffic on it. We'll just scale it down. The chaos injection, the latency monkey, that's the one that's really cool where we start slowing down requests within a given service for all of its peers, and we start slowly increasing the latency, and then we start throwing errors, and we make sure the system's resilient overall. Our chaos team is spending a lot of time on where we go with that in the future. And then the gorilla and the Kong, those are a little bit more manual at times. You know, terminating availability zone in Amazon can be a little bit tricky, but they're not going to let us do a network partition like, hey, give my network guys a call and just take out that whole set of racks. So we have to try to simulate it, and we haven't fully mastered it yet, but we can still, we tend to force enough traffic into the other AZs that it simulates a data center loss. And we run over provision to support an availability zone loss at any time. We actually run across three AZs. And then failing a region, that's the one we did even last week, which is just awesome to have that capability, and we're looking to continue on that to have more of a global failover model in the future. So, Simian Army. Efficiency and cost, better pick it up here. Pushing context to people about cost, on the left side, that's our configuration, continuous deployment tool where you put in the number of instances you want. I haven't tested out what number it can take in that box, but I put in 1,000 and it was okay, it took it. So again, we don't constrain what you do. You can deploy whatever you want, whenever you want. But there is a behind-the-scenes impact of that on, say, availability in terms of our reservation pool. So from a cost perspective, we're in a model, probably like a lot of your companies, where we're prioritizing engineering velocity and innovation over absolute cost, right? But at the end of the day, the buck does stop somewhere, and my team plays a little bit of a role in that because we're on the hook for keeping this down. So this graph is sanitized. I took out anything you could use to understand the date or what the business metric is, but there's usually some other things around it there. On the right side, these are engineering organizations by director. So we actually push cost data up to the director level, right? It's their responsibility to understand if the size of their cloud footprint is too much. And we set it in the context of a business metric. So without the business metric, you would see a pretty steep incline up there. But when we factor in, let's say an example business metric is number of movies watched per week or something like that, right? Whatever, you know, it's pins, it's tweets, it's whatever you want. But by having that context, you can look at it in general, and there's seasonal function, you know, seasonal spikes and periodic behavior. But most people sleep pretty well at night knowing that at least we're not growing it much faster than our business metric. So again, this is context over control. Deploy whatever you want. Tool transitions. Sometimes people will build tools. I pointed out the case of the canary analysis where an edge team built that, and then later our insight team built a replacement for it. There's some situations where a team builds something that's so awesome, you're like, I want that, I'm gonna go get it. So Scryer is an example. We had it on the tech blog, it never got open sourced, but people wanted the ability to predictably auto-scale their clusters in production. Our traffic is very consistent a lot of times, week over week. Humans are very periodic animals, or whatever you call it. And so we had the capability to put in a predictive engine that keeps track of the minimum number of resources based on your carrying capacity that each day predictively sets the floor on your auto-scaling group. So even if you're off by a little bit, at least your capacity isn't too far below what you need. Another team built it, we took it over, and now we're extending it, right? So we're sort of getting this benefit of, and the reason I bring this up is we have a discussion internally as sort of the shared services team, to what degree do we need to innovate versus do we need to follow people that are innovating and build what they have? And we find that a lot of times our edge teams and some of the other teams are on the edge of challenges that are hitting them every day, and they end up building solutions. Sometimes we get in there and we build them collaboratively with them. Other times we just happen to pick it up after the fact. But always look to some of those teams that are faster moving. So at least in our organization, there will always be teams that are sort of pushing the bubble. So measuring success. It's hard to put a number on it, but I would say if you have a specific operational pain point you're going after, you can look at your historic data of the number of incidents you're having now related to that. Like, how often is someone doing a push and it's resulting in a rollback or it's rolling in an SPS dip? We've seen that go down over time. We feel that's directly applicable to our tools and making it easier for people to use. I don't know to what degree you guys actually instrument your uptake rates. Like, you can create a really awesome visualization dashboard that shows correlations and does other stuff. But if no one ever clicks to it, how do you know if it's successful or not? And it can just live for some period of time. So we try to track the rate at which people are using our tools, like the build pipeline capability, which is being extended. We track pretty closely how many people are using that a week. We go engage with those teams to find out how we can make it better. And if there's an important team that's not using it, we talk to them, as to the next point, about why they don't like it, right? It's really great to be able to let down your guard, go to your customer and say, hey, we have this great tool. These teams found it valuable. Why do you think it sucks? Like, what doesn't work for you? And sometimes you'll find that one corner case that's real critical to you to incorporate in the tool, and then you get adoption there as well. So as a shared services organization, that was key for us. And the final validation we've seen recently is you actually have teams that are building point solutions, and they get to a situation where they say, you know what, I am tired of writing this tool and maintaining this tool, and what you're proposing to build, or you've already built the foundation for, is better than what I have. Why don't I give you one or two engineers to help you evolve that? And it might be they still stay within their team, but they have a common set of use cases and they're developing together. And that's the real validation of if your operational utilities, I think, are bringing value to everyone. Okay, onwards and upwards, wrapping it up here. So within my team, we're calling it production ready. It's not real catchy, I don't think I'd go sing about it, but we have a set of best practices that we would like teams to apply, primarily through tooling, but over time we have to figure out what the right tools are. So we're going to work with others in the organization, and leaving you with any sort of recommendations or guidance, if you call it that. I would say prioritize the work you're going to go after if you want to lower that operational bar. We have a lot of teams within Netflix. They have a lot of pain in different areas. And there's some teams where you could spend a lot of time solving their use case, but let's say I spend all my time trying to make my pre-compute workload scale up faster. That's great, right? But if they're out and they're dead and they're down, maybe they don't do computes for a couple hours, but at least people can still play a movie. So as the microservice architecture really explodes and our biggest growth is new services, sort of put those into buckets and say, if I'm going to apply operational best practices and build tools to solve a problem, why don't I build them to solve the problem of the person who's sitting at home and can't play a movie, right, versus something internally? That's something we've started to do. And that's the only way I can maintain the leverage I have in terms of the ratio of engineers to the other teams, is it doesn't matter to me if everybody adopts these everywhere. I mean, that's great if they do. Maybe they don't wake up at night. But I really want to make sure that the Netflix user can still stream a movie when they need to. We're going to extend our tooling. This RTA module thing really took off. So auto-scaling, another area of sort of, you know, black magic. Everybody has to understand the details, but they shouldn't have to understand it. So we're going to try to abstract that away. And then we're going to build our reliability engineering base. We're putting more focus on reliability engineering than we ever had, and I think it's a function of scale, right? And a lot of you are in that case where if you have an outage and it lasts for more than like a minute, there's suddenly tweets going around like, hey, where'd this site go? And, you know, Netflix is like, oh, Netflix is my boyfriend or whatever. You know, and they hate us. You get some really nasty tweets when something goes wrong. So our goal is to continue to improve that availability and not encumber our engineering teams with more process, because we aren't really allowed to have process. That's it. Does anybody have any questions for me? Sure. Oh, thanks.
Rajesh Nishtala from Facebook. Great talk. Thank you.
No, thanks.
So I had a question about the Chaos Monkey and the different Simian army that you guys had.
Yes.
More on the company culture. How did you guys convince a lot of engineering teams around the company that, hey, you know, we're just going to come around and start shooting instances. We're going to start taking this stuff down.
Yeah.
You better get ready for it, and you better prioritize it in your roadmaps to make it work.
Luckily, we had a bunch of people that were really risk takers back when we moved to the cloud around the 2009 timeframe. So you think about like Adrian Cockcroft and some of the other people there. They thought, we're doing this stuff in the data center. We're having a lot of issues. I don't know. Maybe they came up with this over a beer or something. They're like, hey, let's just shoot stuff. Why don't we have this availability. We should be able to kill anything at any time. And they put it in place, and at the time, I believe the engineering organization was a little smaller, and maybe they got more buy-in, but now we had an issue where we had to reboot a bunch of servers on Amazon, and there was a team who doesn't run Chaos Monkey, and they were like pinging us, like, hey, how come my servers are having problems? And we're like, you opted out of Chaos Monkey. So then they opted in. Right. So usually it takes by failure and someone having to feel the pain.
Okay. Cool. Thanks.
Sure.
Hi, thanks for the great talk. A couple questions. What do you know about what's going to happen later in this season of House of Cards?
You know, I don't have anything.
Can you get Kevin Spacey's autograph? What's it like working with him, really?
You know, at our 50 million party, I met Doug Stamper. That was fun. But the Spaceys did not show. I mean, Spacey and what's her name? They didn't show up. The okay. Underwoods. See,
the Underwoods.
I'm an expert on
yeah.
that.
Okay. Yeah. So is your team, or these teams that you've mentioned, are they all in California, or are they globally distributed?
Our CDN team has people globally, not just for support, I think for engagement with local regions. But Netflix has a culture where all 1,000 engineers are in 5 buildings over in Los Gatos, which is awesome because, you know, we don't have any conference calls. You want to talk to someone, you're just like, hey, why don't we go meet and have an espresso? So I have lots of espresso. That's why it's in my picture.
Right.
But you just have such this intimate relationship, and you're all in the same time zone. I'm hoping that's going to continue to scale. It's a line our management's held on pretty tightly, and I think we've seen the value of it.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Hi. You've got opt-in by default. Once you've opted in, is there any way to know after a particular failure that the failure was caused by the Chaos Monkey so that you're not spinning wheels debugging something which is...
Yeah, we do have a dashboard. We have like a monkey dashboard, and you can go filter by chaos events and see if your instance was affected. So we do have an audit trail. It even goes into our Chronos system, right? Because you don't want to like... It could be we killed something critical. We've had some cases where it kills something that shouldn't have been killed.
Right.
Infrequent.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
So at least judging by the screenshots you have, I'm pretty impressed with the quality of your tools. But I'm curious whether there's a lot of reinvention of the wheel, or whether you have a way to kind of control like whether teams invent their own versions of these things and
internally.
Yeah.
Oh, you're saying like if a team built something and then we
well,
got
so
to
I've worked in bigger companies that yeah. that basically everybody. Tended to scratch their own itches,
yeah.
and then you know one thing might win out because it was objectively the best.
I see.
But it looks like you're managing to concentrate resources a little bit better than that. So I'm wondering if there are like cultural norms behind that, or like politics, or what?
Not really. You know, usually there's such this freedom for teams to develop what they want, and they do it in collaboration. And what happens is, regardless of what they build, if it becomes successful, they don't want to maintain it. Because it's everybody's coming and bothering them, then they come to us, and we're pretty open to, let's take what you have and make it better, or in some cases we'll just rewrite it. I don't know if that answers your question of why we're sort of a central team.
I guess what you're implying is that you have built up a lot of trust, that teams will just come to you and
Yes, yeah, that's true. Okay. There are some tools out there that teams still build and other people use them, like they don't have to come to us, but I think they find that since we're sort of a central organization, we tend to come across more use cases, and our tools do tend to evolve a bit faster versus working with someone who only solves their one use case. So, but it's all about trust, absolutely.
How long has this central tools team existed?
We've existed for a while, probably 3 to 4 years, but I think in the last year and a half, we had a new manager come in, and he really worked on cleaning up the model and focusing. I mean, the fact that we renamed it to Operations Engineering, he really got behind having a solidified approach, and I think we've benefited from that greatly.
Very cool, thank you.
Sure.
Hi. My question is, you seem to be working, collaborating all across Netflix, and your success is having a very reliable site, I agree. But there's always a chance when you work with other teams that you're helping more than actually solving a problem, and you're taking a lot of their work and effort.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you draw a line, and how do you say, this is what we own, and this as a centralized team, we do?
Well, I think...
And your success criteria on it.
Yeah. The only place we typically overlap with teams is maybe tools or methodology where we collaborate. As an organization, we don't own anybody's operations. Like on my performance team, I don't own anybody's performance. They own their performance. I create tools and capabilities for them to make it better. Mm-hmm. But we don't do people's pushes for them, right? We don't do QA for them. That's all still within each of the teams.
Mm-hmm.
And so those lines tend to not be very strict. And I don't feel like we're stepping on toes very often.
Right. My question was more like when they depend too much on you, when other teams at times.
I don't think we're there yet. We're trying to get there. I'm fine having people depend on us. I think we're very dependable. But we are still in that phase of building up trust in some of the areas. We'll see when we get there if they get too dependent. But there's a lot of individualism, I think, at Netflix within teams. Like, they want an identity. And so I don't think it's going to go too far that direction. Sure.
Follow up to that last question. How do you measure the success of operations engineering?
I think back to... when I think about measuring success, you know, we have those two dimensions: increase engineering velocity, and that's pretty easy for us to measure. We have build tools, we have push schedules, and we can say our tooling is helping accelerate that. The dimension I'm talking about today is, how do we make sure we're not adversely affecting availability? So it's a little bit soft, right? But what we can look at is, if we spent the time, we could go back and look at it and say, well, we had all these outages because circuits weren't tuned, and now we aren't, right? We pat ourselves on the back. We haven't got to that point yet. We don't spend a lot of time on that analysis. There's a little bit of like an inherent model that we are improving things. And usually the validation is, teams find it's very easy to get their stuff in production. There's very low errors, and we're happy with that. Sure.
On efficiency and capacity management with respect to the Simian Army,
mm-hmm.
I'm not asking about how much resources are allocated to run the Simian Army, but rather it seems that every team that opts in has to overbuild a little bit because of the existence of Chaos Monkey, et cetera. Is there a tough debate about how frequently
we terminate stuff
because you have to overbuild for that amount?
As a general strategy for availability, you know, Amazon has multiple data centers in each region, and we make sure that the teams that are in the front line, like servicing user traffic, they over-provision each of the availability zones to support the loss of any zone, which means each remaining zone has to have enough capacity to have a 50% increase in workload plus support scale-up. So most people are running with a buffer, and it's not noticeable. And we aren't super aggressive. It isn't like we're going to shoot them all down like, hey, they aren't going to catch it at this time. We probably terminate maybe, you know, once every other day or something for a given service, and we just pick one, right? It's just making sure one can go away. We don't do something dramatic like kill half their farm. So it's measured.
Thanks.
Sure. All right. I think we're about out of time. Thanks, everybody.